My name is John Schramm, and the title of this session is A Disarmed Life, Nonviolence in the New Testament. How many were here last week to hear a session called Extravagant Love, Nonviolence in the New Testament? Okay, I just want you to know this is the same topic as just my way of doing it. Last week it was Mary's way of doing it, and I wanted to tell some of you who had heard that, maybe you had Course 1 in Nonviolence in the New Testament and wanted to do something else this hour. I'm aware that the typical style at Holden is for me to present for a while and then for us to talk about it. I'd like to switch that for just a couple minutes at the beginning. Before I say something, it tends as though the truth comes from here and you receive it. I mean, the setup has me kind of here. At least I'm not in a pulpit, which is always about 2 feet above criticism, at least. But I would like for you to do just a little thinking before I start talking. Nonviolence in the New Testament, or the phrase, a disarmed life, and I put enough up here that one of them ought to hit you. Does that bring up any expectations on your part? What did you expect when you came to a session where this was the title? Does it raise any images for you? Does it raise any questions for you? Would you just give that 30 seconds time? Pick one of those or a couple of those, nonviolence in the New Testament or a disarmed life, expectations, questions, images. Would you share with one other person for 20 seconds each, just so you have said something and heard something before I start. Would you do that? One other person? You don't have to report back. Just... Well, help me immeasurably if I know your first reaction to the title. It will help, and I think it will help other people to know that there's lots of different images and expectations that come from that title. Some of you, just either what you said or what someone said to you, we won't know, so we don't know if it's yours or theirs. Anybody? You all talked. What did you say?
I have a problem with society and nonviolence, and I've always wondered what community we live in has a really big drug problem right now. And so I see this as two sides of a coin. As a person, the older I get, the more I can really buy into nonviolent life and turn the other cheek and so forth. But how does society function in a
world? One more. Yeah.
The thing is, the restoration of harmony in the old shalom idea.
Good. Thank you. All right. Each of my sessions I have started with several poems from Gerhard Frost, and I want to do that. They always link somehow with the topic. If they don't link directly, it hasn't bothered me thus far. So I remember a little pair of shoes. For months, they stood side by side on the closet floor, begging for feet. We had an active four-year-old who ran and danced through the days with always new plans for the morrow. But then one day she lay still in a distant hospital while the weeks went by. It was polio. We had shopped for shoes, and she loved these especially because they were her first that tied. I remember praying as we put them aside that they would be worn again. That experience taught me that it is high privilege to support life. Never since have I complained about the price of children's shoes. Life is meant to beget and sustain more life. To grow tired is not tragedy if one is living by loving and dying by giving. The call to discipleship is to come and die. Usually not in one burst of effort, nor in a single pool of blood, but in the steady self-draining of life strength and energy. There's no room for self-pity in the lived life. Only the unlived quality of our existence should ever make us sad. And one that I used last week when Dan Spencer and I had a session together, it fit that one and it fits this one, I think. I remember my mouthy days, my dazzling debates with Mom and Dad. Like a winner, confidently I'd argue. Condescendingly I would instruct. Tolerantly I'd repeat myself. Then patiently I'd wait. Until without a moment's warning, one of them would say, "You know we love you." "Foul!" I'd yearn to cry. And I'd want out. They'd struck so hard and below the belt. Love cheats. It always does. There's no defense. It is somewhat difficult to have a session on nonviolence for lots of reasons. One of them is the term is a negative term, and in our English language, that means the first reaction might be we are talking about the absence of something rather than something very positive. Do you feel the difference? For instance, we're going to take these off and put a few other things on the board. I could have entitled this session Satyagraha. Would you have come? How many would have, if that was the only thing up on the board and I had started, "Are there any questions?" The first one would have been, "What does it mean?" How many would have had some idea? There's at least one. Oh, good. All right. Three, four. Mahatma Gandhi coined the word. He created the word partly out of the dilemma that I just said was our dilemma tonight. He could have used a word in his language, ahimsa. Himsa is the word for violence, and in his language, like ours, often you can make it the opposite by adding an A in the beginning. So ahimsa is nonviolence. Satyagraha, it's almost impossible to bring into the... You have to walk around in it for a while. I can't have an easy equal sign, but truth, power, soul, power, at least you have to get the feeling that it's a force, not just the absence of something. So maybe we should have had active, reconciling, nonviolence in the New Testament. You see what I mean? We should have maybe described it a little bit. So we could have talked about Satyagraha. It would have been, it's very good stuff if you ever get a chance to read Gandhi. And by the way, if you think, but this was in the New Testament and he wasn't even Christian. Would anybody have dared to say that here? He wasn't even Christian. Haven't you heard people talk like that? Somebody once asked Gandhi, "Where did you get the concept of nonviolence?" And his answer was the Sermon on the Mount and the teachings of Jesus. And they said, "But you're not a Christian." And he said, "I looked and the Christian church does not follow Jesus." So I took the Sermon on the Mount and his teachings and tried to live them out because I didn't want to join a group that doesn't seem to try to do that. Okay? So it could have been Satyagraha and still have been nonviolence in the New Testament. Or we should know that what we're going to talk about is how do you respond to conflict situations. That's what we're talking about, conflict situations. If your way is to flee from them, you won't ever know if you're nonviolent or not. You never had the chance to find out. You see what I mean? It isn't just the absence of violence. You can have the absence of violence by always running away from anything that might be a conflict situation. And then you won't know. But that's not what we're talking about tonight. We're talking about how do you confront enemies? How do you live in Yakima? How is it when you're poor and you're being oppressed? How do you respond to conflict? There are... many possible answers. Let me put the first one up here that looks a little bit like this one. Conflict situations, the one the world knows the best is fight. And that's one possible response. You can try, if it is a conflict situation, you can try in the middle of it to remain neutral. You didn't get away fast enough. So you are there, but you try your best not to take sides. Or you can surrender. If this was a weekend in nonviolent training, we would spend more time. The point I'm trying to make at the beginning is I think everyone knows that we're talking about the opposite of fight. That much we know. I want you to know that in the New Testament and in the concept we're talking about tonight, we're talking about something that is none of these, none of the above. I think people tend to think that nonviolence is the opposite of fight and some combination of flight, neutrality, and capitulation. No. Do you get it yet? I once had this topic and I spent one solid hour on one point. It is not passive. That's all I tried to do in an hour. Sometimes you have modest goals. I told over and over again, it is not passive. Pacifist is not passivist. There's a difference. You work for peace. Here you are passive, not active. Okay, enough. That's kind of the technical, setting it in context. All right. For tonight, we have a basic premise. If we're going to talk about nonviolence in the New Testament, we have a norm. And the norm is Jesus. That's probably going to be the main thing that I say. I have 3 points. But if you get weary that the first one is of equal length with the other two and you're never going to get to Vespers at 7:30, rest assured that if we can get the first one really kind of laid in place, we will understand something about a disarmed life. Jesus is the norm. John Howard Yoder has an article called The Disarmed Life. And in there he takes all the possible reasons that the Christian church may feel that they should love enemies. And then he begins checking off the ones that are really not correct because they're such lovable people. No, that isn't it at all. That we think with enough love we will conquer them. No, that's not necessarily true, historically or in reality. That we love some other country better than this one. That's not true at all. That there's some economic system that we prefer to this one. No, this one is the one we live in. There's only one reason to love your enemies, because God does. And God tells God's people to do it too. That's the only reason, and it is enough. Jesus is our norm. There are lots and lots of debates about nonviolence and whether or not it's a practical way to live. I'm not sure that that's your question, but that's certainly probably the major question that we have. In fact, some of these debates on different sides of this issue are published. They're usually not bestsellers. They just happen to be of a great interest to me. And one of them were the debates between Reinhold Niebuhr and John Howard Yoder. And they were published. It's in pamphlet form. Reinhold Niebuhr had been a pacifist, and at the outbreak of the Second World War, he felt you could no longer hold that position. And he wrote a pamphlet on why the Christian is not a pacifist. And John Yoder, a Mennonite and a pacifist, continued to correspond back and forth, and they wrote. I want you to know that they did agree on the fact that if you took Jesus as your norm, you would be nonviolent. You would not participate in war. In other words, Reinhold Niebuhr, who was arguing on the side that you could not be a pacifist when you had this awful situation in the world, did not base his premise on the teachings of Jesus. He said it is absurd the people who use Jesus as proof passages because he drove money changers out of the temple. There's no indication that he used the whips even on the animals. If the image is the most likely, he used a whip the way anybody who drives cattle uses a whip. You crack it. And there's certainly no indication that he whipped other people. He drove money changers out of the temple as a kind of righteous God's house is for prayer, but you can't prove he is violent by that. Or cursing a fig tree. It's an obscure passage anyway. Or once when he said, how many weapons do we have? And one of the disciples said, two swords. And Jesus says, it is enough. And Niebuhr said, we are so slow we can't even understand Jewish humor. That's what it was. It's enough to fight the Roman army? And the Greek had two words. One was a sword that was a weapon, and the other was a modification of a Swiss hunting knife, something that almost everybody wore to go into the wilderness, and it was that kind of sword. What Niebuhr was saying is you cannot use Jesus as your norm and come to any conclusion other than a thoroughgoing nonviolence, but, and then Niebuhr was very articulate, by admitting you can't always follow Jesus in a fallen world. That was his argument. Do you catch it? That's significant. That's significant. When we follow Jesus and then engage in violence, we ought to confess that. We did not follow you, Lord. We shouldn't bless the war in Jesus' name. We should say, for whatever reason, I was unable to follow you. There's a long standing kind of poem. You want my land? I understand. Just don't blame God. That's what we've done with most of the wars we've had. We've called them in some way or another a crusade. The most recent is kill a commie for Christ. No New Testament justification. That's my point. If Jesus is the norm, we are called to follow in a way that mirrors the kind of, now I'll use Mary's term for this session, the extravagant love with which we've been loved. And what I'm saying tonight is I think that's the call upon the church, to look at what that means in any given situation. Roman Catholic bishops in this country had a very fine statement on peace. They've had one since on the economy, and they raised good discussions. One of the things that's kind of ironic is there's always more discussion while those papers are in draft form than after they've been passed. Then they're filed away. I wish they kept it in draft form with everybody talking about them. But Daniel Berrigan, in his own way, critiqued the bishop's statement on peace. And he said, I looked in the bibliography and they interviewed more people from the State Department than they did from the New Testament departments of our seminaries. And he said, were they embarrassed by the Sermon on the Mount? Why, if you're going to make a statement on peace, do you interview our State Department? And then Dan Berrigan, in vintage Berrigan, said, it would be like Peter consulting with Pilate during Holy Week. My point tonight is quite clear. Jesus is the norm. And that we haven't really lived that norm or even admitted it. Most of us, let me see if I can catch how many I include if I say mainline Protestants, Methodist, Presbyterian, Lutheran, Disciples, Roman Catholic, Greek Orthodox. How many have I hit in this room if I've listed those denominations? Now, there's at least one Mennonite in the village. He's at the head of laundry. Is he here? Okay. Is there any Mennonite in the village? Church of the Brethren, Quaker. Those are the three peace churches. The rest of us have as our criteria the justifiable war criteria. My point tonight, and I'm not going to indict us for it or make a big point of it, the justifiable war criteria are based on Greek philosophy, not on Jesus. They are based more on the premise we can't follow Jesus in a fallen world. Let's get some criteria that limits the violence as much as possible, which is an admirable thing. It is not based on Jesus. I want to tell a couple stories about what it might mean if we took Jesus as our norm. One of my favorite books is called Brother to a Dragonfly by Will Campbell. It has great gospel images. If you want to read a novel, but autobiographical and true, about the relationship of two brothers, and have it filled with gospel images, sometime pick up Brother to a Dragonfly, Will Campbell. I want to tell only one incident, but you have to know the background. You know, that's what's nice about a novel, and I have to give it to you too quickly, but let me give you the setting and then the one incident. The main characters first. Will Campbell is a Southern preacher. He knows Southern people. He was raised there. He's appreciative of the South and the Deep South. His brother Joe is the dragonfly. You'll have to read the book to know why. He's always a little worried about Will. He's a little bit of a caretaker, and he thinks Will is going to get in trouble because Will is working for civil rights among his own people who do not want anybody, especially preachers, meddling in the issue of blacks and whites being together. And then there's their friend P.D. East. P period, D period, East. If you haven't lived in the South, that's his name, P.D. We're not used to that up north, but that's common in the South. And P.D. East is a character. I don't mean only a figure in the story. He is a character. Sharp-witted, sharp-tongued, sarcastic, atheist, legal person. And he and Will have some great visits. Will could honestly say, P.D. East is a hemorrhoid in my life. There's a couple things that P.D. always does. P.D. is always pressing Will about how Christians are not very sincere. And he has a term for it. He says, Will, you and your Christians, you're Easter chickens. Do you know what that means, Will? I got my kid an Easter chicken, and it was purple. It was different from all the other chickens. And I put it out, and it acted different. All the others kind of treated it different because it was purple. Didn't take long, Will. The feathers started to grow out. It wasn't purple at all. It was a Rhode Island red. They had to put a little dye on there. It took 2 or 3 weeks. You couldn't tell it from all the other chickens. You couldn't tell in the pecking order. You couldn't tell how it acted, and you couldn't tell how it looked. That's what you Christians are like, Will. Set you down somewhere, and you'll just fit right in. There's nothing distinctive about you. Story after story, kind of putting the knife to Will. He had a particular ongoing question of Will Campbell. He said, Will, I think the reason I'm not a Christian is I've never had anybody explain it to me in a way that I could understand in 10 words or less. If you could do that, Will, I might be a Christian. So Will had always had this challenge. And it wasn't long ago, before this incident, that Will had taken a stab at defining Christianity in less than 10 words in a way that P.D. East might be converted. He didn't even use all 10 words. Here's the definition. We're all bastards, but God loves us anyhow. And P.D. was impressed. He said, I can understand it, Will. And if you're saying that's what Christianity is, I'll give it some thought. I might want to be one. Those are the three main characters. Now the incident. One of Will's favorite people was an Episcopal seminarian from up north, Jonathan Daniels. He and some others had come down to do voter registration so that they might work toward blacks having an equal voice in the voter's box. And Jonathan Daniels, Will said, was one of the most lovable young men he had ever met. Took such kind thoughts to him and was glad he was there. Well, Jonathan Daniels and a Roman Catholic priest and two young blacks from Hayville, Alabama had been working on voter registration and arrested. They were put in prison and let out in the middle of the day without any escort or protection. into the middle of the center street of that town, and an off-duty deputy sheriff named Thomas Coleman came through town with a rifle slung in the back window of his pickup truck, saw these integrationists, and opened fire. The two blacks ran and got away. The priest was wounded, and Jonathan Daniels was killed. Will Campbell didn't know that. So he came home, and in his living room was Brother Joe and P.D. East. And Joe said, "Will, don't you know a Jonathan Daniels?" And Will started, "Do I know Jonathan Daniels? I love the young man." And Joe said, "Will, he's dead." And Will just slumped in a chair. "Oh, no." And so Joe told him the whole story of what had happened. And Will, in the middle of that shock, was confronted by P.D. East. Said, "Will, we have a working definition of Christianity, and we're going to test it. Was that Jonathan Daniels a bastard?" And Will said, "He was the most lovable. I didn't say, what did you think of him? I said, you know, according to our working definition. Was he a bastard?" And Joe said, "For God's sake, P.D., let him alone." P.D. said, "Well, no, if we have a working definition, it has to work all the time. Was he a bastard?" Finally, Will Campbell said, "Yeah." He said, "How about that other one, that Thomas Coleman that shot him? Was he a bastard?" "That was quick." "Yes," Will said. And then P.D. moved close, and he put his bony fingers on Will's knee. And he got up right next to Will's nose, and he said, "Okay, Will, I'd like to know, which of the two bastards did God love the most?" And Will got up, and he bounced off the walls of the room, crying and laughing all at the same time. Going through his head, because of P.D.'s question, was more theological education than he got in Baptist Sunday school, a Christian college, and a theological seminary. And he started to think, if loved, then reconciled. And if reconciled, then part of God's family. And a whole new ministry opened up for Will Campbell that was there the rest of his life. He worked for civil rights, but he could not cut off communication with the Ku Klux Klan after that moment. A whole thing about what the Christian faith meant in regard to enemy love just threw him around the room. And P.D. and Joe did not know what was going on. And when Joe finally settled down, he went over to P.D. and he said, "P.D., I never used all 10 words, but I'm going to use them now. We are all bastards, and you're the biggest bastard of them all." And P.D. said, "What do you mean?" He said, "You're about to make a Christian out of me, and I don't think I can stand it." That's gospel. Pure gospel. Of enemy love as the distinctive mark of God's loving all of us bastards. Jesus is the norm. Is that theoretical? Well, maybe for me. And maybe it is a little middle class to talk about, but it's not theoretical if you mean, have there been people who lived that? And because they lived that, there was power. There wouldn't be a Christian church if that hadn't been lived as the most remarkable testimony of what God is like that the world has ever known. You missed 2 weeks of a man from South Africa on teaching staff, and he told his story about what it was to be in prison. I got here just after. I'm sorry I missed the story. But I've heard other stories. At Augsburg College, Simon Ferrisani told his story one morning. Imprisoned, tortured, and when he finished, you couldn't help but be moved and inspired and also kind of intimidated about, would I have faith like that? But the first question was, where did you get the courage to live with that, to live like that in prison? And Ferrisani was obviously embarrassed by the question. because he said, I'm so embarrassed when you ask that. I wish you had been there. I had almost no courage at all. My knees shook and turned to jump. I was like a little boy in panic when I heard the torturers come down the hall. I did not have courage. I'm sorry I gave you that impression. He said, I will tell you what I did. I took Jesus at his word. And so at the beginning of the day, first of all, I prayed for my enemies. That's what Jesus said to do. I had no courage, but I tried to be faithful. Time for my family, my children, I prayed. And at the end, if I had any time for myself, but I did what Jesus said, and I sensed a presence in my cell. I didn't have courage. I had the risen Christ responding to my faithfulness. That's all I had. And it was enough. Oh, it's not theoretical. Jesus is the norm. I want to go to part two. Our reality is violence. Jesus is the norm, but where we live is in violence. In other words, if you think that nonviolence in the New Testament is based upon the assumption that we live in a world in which all people are nice, or if you think it's based on the assumption of naivete about what the real world is like, nothing could be farther from the truth. I told the story last week in regard to contemplation. I told a story that Mulford Sibley, who taught at the University of Minnesota, a Quaker, gave a beautiful, moving lecture on pacifism once. And one of the first questions was, I've heard you pacifists before. You're simply naive as to the reality of evil in the world. And Dr. Sibley, always gracious, said, oh no, you couldn't have misunderstood more. It isn't that we are naive to the reality of evil. We have seen it so clearly. It's shattering when you see it so clearly. We've seen evil so clearly that we refuse to have any of it in our response to it. That's not naivete. That's a second naivete, if you want the language of Paul Ricoeur, after you know the facts. That's what we're talking about. So I'm not so totally unhappy that we have to use the word non-violence, because I think what it says is you have to have something non, contrary, counter to the prevailing reality of the world, which is violent. That's what we're talking about. Do you like Stokely Carmichael's line? How violent is it in America? It's as American as apple pie. Do you remember that? White folks were just incensed by that. That's absolutely true. You look at the brief history of the United States. I once saw it done by a filmmaker in 60 seconds. And all of our wars and all of our violence went by my, you know, your eyes take it in faster than you think. Just incredible history of violence. Mary and I once got to teach or visit in Cameroon, and I can still remember, we came from the country where the missionaries had come from. So they made assumptions about what the country where the missionaries came from must be like. And it was touching, but very ironic. This marvelous man came up and said, we are Christians, we are baptized, but you should know we still have violence between our tribes. We are not yet at the point of Christian nonviolence like you in the United States are. And I had to break the news. I had to break the news. We live in a violent society. But I have a question. If Jesus is the norm, even if we live in a violent society, at what other points do we wait until the world votes okay till we move ahead following Jesus? Do you always wait until the whole community agrees before you are faithful? There wouldn't be a Christian church if people had concluded that. What we have to offer the world is our understanding of the power of the gospel and the power of Jesus in our life. And if it has become our nature to have Jesus as the norm and to be nonviolent, we don't have to worry about what the rest of the world either does or is like. Mary told the story about the man walking along the dervish or the wise man or the Sufi master, I don't know, but it comes from that tradition. And he saw a tree planted by the stream. The root system had gone under the stream. Probably the stream had changed, so part of the roots were out in the flowing stream, and there was a scorpion way out on the root and couldn't possibly get back. So the old man was trying to save the scorpion. And you know what happened. Time and time again, the scorpion stung him and wouldn't be saved. And a young man came along and said, "Oh, you foolish old man. You'll never get that scorpion back up on the shore. Don't you know it's the nature of a scorpion to sting? You'll get killed." The old man said, "Just because it's the nature of a scorpion to sting does not mean I change my nature, which is to save." Sometimes all we can say is, I think that's the way of being faithful. Faith is not belief in spite of the evidence. That's called stupidity. It was some bishop who said, people think the Christian faith is to believe 631 impossible things before breakfast. That's not the Christian faith. Faith is not belief in spite of the evidence. It's risk in spite of the consequence. That's faith. That's what'll make a church alive. Not arguing about doctrine, but stepping out with Jesus as a norm in the midst of a violent world. I have one more premise tonight on nonviolence, and it's basically because I'm teaching at Holden and not somewhere else. Nonviolence in the New Testament has Jesus as a norm, assumes our reality is violence, and says the turf on which we first express this nonviolence is the parish where we belong. And that's where I'd like to leave us tonight, thinking in terms of where do I probably have a call to start this kind of discipleship of Jesus being the norm. I think it's our local parish. I probably have never given a presentation on nonviolence, and now I'm going to stop somebody who's going to ask it. It's really unfair. If I had enough time for questions, sometime during it, I got a question like, what would you do if someone broke into your house and was about to kill an infant, a harmless, defenseless infant in a cradle? Wouldn't you be violent and sad? Some adaptation of that story. I want you to know, I don't know what I would do. I also want you to know it has never happened yet, but I have lots of daily possibilities to be either violent or nonviolent, and I think I'm called more to be faithful in those than theoretically know what I would do or not do if someone broke into my house. Now it would be my grandchild and was about to harm my grandchild. I don't know. I do know if I have not consistently assumed nonviolence and Jesus as the norm in all of those little daily tests, I will not do well at that big test, which does in fact come to some people. I think the ordinary parish and the people of that parish are probably our first possibility of living out what the New Testament says is the norm of Jesus. I don't think we have anything to offer the world that we don't show in our relationships with one another. I don't think we have any great mission to the world if we continue to be unable to live creatively with those who are in community with us. Bonhoeffer said, "You are not called to complain about the community in which you're placed. You are called to give thanks that you were not called to live out your Christian life all alone." A Jesuit friend of mine had a different way of saying it. He said, "I don't really have so much trouble with the faith. It's the faithful who give me fits." And that's probably the first test we have. These ordinary folks I would like to see, and I hope you have some creativity of continuing it on, whether we get a chance to do it here corporately or you have to do it yourself. I would like to think in terms of what would it take for our congregations to be places where nonviolence was the norm, where Jesus was the norm in regard to how we work together, how we worship together, how we live together. Let me give you a couple, and you add to them. Do we on Sunday morning in the prayer of the church include praying for our enemies? How many come from churches where we pray regularly for our enemies? A few. Okay. Wouldn't that be a start? Isn't that a direct command from Jesus? How many churches have the assumption that catechism, and there's a great rich tradition to catechism. In fact, if you didn't know it, the Sermon on the Mount was probably the first catechism. How many of our catechisms are very much like the early Christian church, where for a couple years you learn what it means to be a follower of the way, and much of the instruction has to do with servanthood and nonviolence and forgiveness, and then When you really have decided this is the way for me, then the last short period of time, in the early church it was called the opening of the ear, you learn the creed, the Lord's Prayer, and what we now think of as the memory work. That's kind of the way this group, who has this particular way of life, worships, and that's important. But the decision would be more on whether or not we really could be followers of the way and declare Jesus is the norm. Would that change catechism instruction in most of our churches? I think it would. How about our libraries? How about our Christian education materials? How about who's openly, visibly welcome at our churches? How about our budgets and where we spend our money? Just think in terms of what if this local parish was a place where we had a chance to test out this common norm that we had, that Jesus calls us primarily to nonviolence. And I hope we would do it with some humor and with some creativity. I remember, these are controversial issues. I'm making it sound, and none of you looks like you're going to attack me, so I just keep going. The Vietnam days, those were some hard times for pastors who tried to speak out about U.S. foreign policy or the war. I remember a Catholic priest in Washington, D.C., stood up in the pulpit and said, the sermon will be about the... what was that? Cambodia invasion and the U.S. policy in Vietnam. And the whole place just stiffened up. And then he paused a little bit and said, 4 weeks from this morning. And then he went ahead and preached on the text for the day. And what he did in those 4 weeks, because everybody was aware of his announcement, they had all kinds of congregational gatherings to discuss just those issues. And they had arenas where you could give and take. He didn't want to do that from the pulpit, which I already told you is about 2 feet above criticism. He thought that was unfair. But he used that as the announcement to get their interest up. By the time it was the subject of the Sunday Mass 4 weeks later, they were able to handle it. That was very creative. Very creative. A Lutheran pastor friend of mine during that same era was pastor of a Missouri Synod church in Washington, D.C., right downtown. And it was that one point in the Vietnam War, again, I think it was the Cambodian invasion, there was one point at which a whole new group of college students came to protest, the ones who had not been on the streets before. And so the kids from our Lutheran colleges this time came to Washington, D.C. And they went to the first, these happened to be Missouri Synod young people, they went to the first Missouri church they found, they got the pastor's phone number and they explained who they were and they said, can we sleep on the floor of your church tonight? We're here for the big protest Monday. So when the members arrived, he didn't have time to have a church council meeting. This was late Saturday night that they called. When the members arrived, the floor was covered with peace protesters. You had to step over them to get into your own church. The first sensible thing he did was change the sermon. Because the texts were not what people were thinking about. His sermon was, why are all these kids sleeping on our floor? What's it all about? So that helped a little bit, but there were still people so upset. One man, Roy, stood at the door wanted to shake people's hand. One man was so angry that he hugged the wall on the other. He could not be touched by Roy. And Roy said, "Good morning." He said, "I'm so angry I can't even talk." And Roy said, "Could you by Wednesday night?" He said, "Excuse me?" He said, "How long does it take you to cool down? Would you be able to talk by Wednesday night?" "I guess so." And Roy spent 3 hours with him. Those were both pastoral acts, letting the kid sleep on the floor and spending 3 hours with a member who was upset. Both pastoral acts. We have to have some common sense, and we'll have to have some good humor. But how do you envision your own parish if New Testament nonviolence really is important to the faith? Can you picture some things that you might do at your own parish? We got a few minutes yet. We will judge all of your parishes if someone doesn't say something.
Okay,
John, sure.
I see the norm of nonviolence as a norm which is very good ethics.
Okay.
But there will be exceptions to the norm. It is not an absolute norm. And I would try to tell my parish, if I would get a chance to do so, because I'm a layman, where the exceptions on the norm are, and the danger that the exceptions will become the norm.
Okay, all right. Good start. Okay. And there are many places where you could start with the norm.
Yes.
Immediately. Yes. Immediately. Yes.
How would a nonviolent parish handle the sheriff that killed his friend? How would a nonviolent parish? So you told the story of the people that were signing up the blacks to vote.
Yeah.
One of them was killed.
Yeah.
How would a nonviolent parish handle the man that did the murder?
I think, I'm assuming that Will Campbell, I mean, he told that as one incident, and it isn't a book which is a sermon book, it's a story, but I'm assuming from what he said that that was the beginning of his ministry to the Ku Klux Klan. And that P.D. East's question, as ornery as it was, made him realize that God loved Thomas Coleman too. And if God did, he had to. And part of the ministry of certain parishes to people on death row, and part of the ministry of people to people that the rest of us would say is our public enemy number one, would flow from a parish that really did have Jesus as the norm. I mean, that's my premise tonight. I don't know what that would mean in literal action that they would take. Maybe you have a guess on that, but...
Well, would the parish put him in death row?
Oh, capital punishment. What would be the answer on capital punishment?
Is that one individual.
Okay. You got some... What does nonviolence say about the issue of whether or not the state takes somebody's life? You want to get into that one?
It's murder.
It's a murder if the state does it, or they...
State murder.
It's state murder. There's one response. It's violence, someone else says. Would it be one of your exceptions that's necessary to the norm?
No, I mean, it is murder, period.
Oh, okay. You would not make that an exception. I think this could probably be a forum instead of 30 seconds of people sharing, but those are the kind of tough questions that come, right? Anybody else want to speak to it? You're about to. No, you're not.
Me?
Uh-huh.
Well, I would agree with him. I mean, I think murder is murder, whether the state does it or the individual does it. Mm-hmm. And I don't think you can justify one murder with another. It's just clear to me that you can't. But I realize that's not a popular position. And I realize, but it seems to me like that's one of the things parishes ought to be talking about, so that that issue is, if not, I mean, people don't, I mean, that ought to be part of the dialogue of the church. The people in that church who feel strongly should take action to try to influence social policy about that.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of my churches are separate. I mean, they see that a law like capital punishment is not within their purview, and it really is.
Mm-hmm. There was a Mennonite who was offered the job of warden of a prison in Canada. And he told them what his religious beliefs were, and they said, well, okay, we'll give it a try. And everything went along fairly well. There was an uprising on the prisoners. He had disarmed all the guards when he became warden. there was an uprising of the prison of the prisoners, and the county board or state board or whatever it was said, arm the guards. And he said no. He talked it over with the guards. They had a strategy session. They used nonviolence, and the revolt was subdued. A couple years later, things got out of hand, and they insisted that he arm the guards. And at that point, he resigned. So he lasted 4 or 5 years. I mean, I'm not saying that's a total answer, but we have to find some people who wrestled conscientiously with Jesus is the norm, but I live in a violent world, and begin to ask those ethical questions for ourselves as to what does it mean to me that Jesus is my Lord, because I live in a world of complicated questions. I think that's part of what the church should be doing, is letting us wrestle with those. We may not come up with all coming up with the same answer, but we do have the same question. I mean, that is a starting point. What does faithfulness to Jesus Christ mean in this situation? And that's probably another way of saying the primary reason for this session is I think this is one of the questions that it means to be a follower of Jesus, is to ask these kinds of questions. Yes?
Incarceration is in itself a violent act.
Yes? Yes?
So whether the man's on death row,
yes,
really is immaterial.
We could have another forum on prison reform. The people who assume that putting people in prison does three things: it rehabilitates people, it protects the innocent, and it's a deterrence to crime. None of those three things are the result of our present prison system. The things we think it's doing, which are all good, it is not doing. So we could have a great forum on that, and we could start with, given the premise of nonviolence, what should we do with criminals? Not just murderers, criminals. It'd be another good kind of ethical question. Well, I promised the people that I would give you time to get to Vesper. Let me just tell one story in conclusion, because this is a Holden story. Some of you know John Nelson. John Nelson is a pastor in Seattle. His mother was Mother of the Year and was a great peace activist. There are marvelous stories about Ruth Youngdahl Nelson. She went out in the little boat to try to stop the Trident, and when the Coast Guard came and aimed the water cannon, she stood up. What was she, maybe 78 years old at that point? Anyway, she stood up and said, "Young man, put that down." And he did. But Jonathan Nelson has been working against the arms race for years and years, and he came up to Holden. He was at a pastor's conference here. Came up to Holden, and he has a great grin from ear to ear. It's contagious, his grin. And he came up to take the bread and the wine, and Dan Erlander was the pastor that day, and Dan has his own way of kind of asking nice questions. So he went up, he's a good friend of John, said, "John, you have worked for the end of the arms race and for a reduction in the military arms race for 25 years. But you keep smiling. Do you realize it's worse now than 25 years ago?" And John smiled even more broadly. He said, "Oh, yes." And Dan said, "Well, how do you keep going and why do you keep smiling?" And John answered, "Because I know how the story ends." Not a bad way to end our session. Thank you.